You are listening to WWBC Coco, Merritt Island, 1510 AM, as well as W234BI Coco, Rockledge, 94.7 FM, W264AS, Rockledge, Melbourne, Palm Bay, Indy Atlantic, Indian Harbor Beach, Satellite Beach, 100.7 FM, and W260CL Coco, 99.9 FM.
Hello, space and treasure coast. This is Sita Begee on AM 1510 WWBC, FM 94.7, FM 99.9, 100.7. And we're also heard on the World Wide Web. All over, Miss Helen.
We are. We're on 1510 WWBC. You can just click that on-demand button. You may have to download something, but for most browsers, you can just click on that, and you'll hear us live each and every Monday right here at 1 o'clock. Also, all of our shows are archived, and they're on our CETAMediaInc.com website. And we also post everything on the Facebook page. And thank you so much, Samantha, for all of the help on Facebook and getting all the word out for all of our guests and for the Viewpoint with CETA and Friends show.
My pleasure, ladies. Thank you for having me.
Right. And so we have an action-packed show today. My friend Ann Lewis is calling in from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. She is a psychotherapist. Send her the number to call in. Again, just to be on the safe side of Miss Ellen. So she's a psychotherapist in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. She's a writer and a lecturer. And she's been a friend of our show for such a long time, Miss Ellen, that we know that she believes in a loving, kind society.
Yeah, and she talks a lot about the foundational spirit of everybody, about it speaking from the home.
Right.
You know, just like you talk about being, you know, around the kitchen table and having meals together and those types of things. So, I mean, every time that she's called in, it's been very inspirational.
Uplifting.
And that everybody can do it.
Right. And
everybody
so
can.
She's the former founder of the Woman's Journey. She studied at Nova Southeastern University, and she lives in Fort Lauderdale, and I met her through a really good friend of mine, through my curry chicken meals.
Yeah, of course.
So, and then our second segment, we have a professor. Her name is Dr. Alka Kanaya. She is a professor of medicine and epidemiology.
Yes.
And biostatics at the University of California, San Francisco. And she's going to be calling in to speak about diabetes. She's an expert in type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease prevention.
Okay.
And she's going to be calling in the second segment. We'll talk a little bit about atherosclerosis, South Asians living in the United States. It's called MASALA. And so that's the second segment. So the first segment, of course, is with our friend Ann Lewis. And I know she's on the phone. And before we go to her, Ellen, you know, this weekend was Valentine's Day.
Yes.
Right? And how did you spend your Valentine?
I played music. So, you know, I have a band, got a couple of bands, actually. So we played music all weekend and had a fantastic time learning about people's anniversaries and first dates. And so it was kind of fun because you get to be part of people's lives at different stages.
And
so it was neat.
Samantha, you had a good Valentine's as well?
Yes, I did. Very good one. My husband cooked for me, so that's a good day.
I worked in the nursing home yesterday for Valentine's Day.
So you heard about anniversaries and
yeah, you know what I did?
Too?
I decided to ask my residents who are alert and oriented. Some of them are not. They have Alzheimer's, but I still ask them about their Valentine's. And it's amazing. You know, the older generation have such a wealth of information, their knowledge, the time, the challenging times that they faced. And for a lot of them, love is not just about sex. Love was about living is giving. Love was about sharing is caring. Love was about paying the bills for your family. Love was about reaching out to your sisters and brothers and making sure that they're okay.
It was about what you did. It wasn't what you said.
Right. Love.
Or what you bought.
Love to a lot of them were about caring about their neighbors. So, you know, nowadays when you talk about Valentine's Day, people think it's only about love for a man and a woman or a woman and whoever is a love in your life, right? Your partner, right? But a lot of these people, their Valentine's Day incorporated their children and their extended families. So I thought that was really wonderful. And a lot of them talked about remembering their husbands walking in the rain. One lady told me she met her husband at a park. One lady told me she had a terrible Valentine because her husband left her for a redhead in a bar.
The dirt.
Yeah. One woman told me that she was grateful that her son sent her flowers every Valentine's. And that's an important thing, too. You know, a lot of children have forgotten to send their parents a card or maybe a phone call or maybe some flowers for Valentine's. I mean, to me, living on God's magnificent planet and enjoying our earthly vacation called life is about giving back. It's the rent we pay for living. Mm-hmm. It's activism, right?
That's right.
So on that fancy note, I'll just have our friend Dr. Ann Modi Lewis join in on the conversation. Thank you for calling in today, Doctor.
Yeah, Sita, good morning, or good afternoon, I should say. Nice to be with you.
Thank you so
much. Yeah, I was listening to your words, beautiful words, and that's called the practice of love. Love is something that we have to practice, and it takes effort and commitment to practice love.
Right, I think nowadays a lot of people have forgotten what the word commitment actually means, and it, you know, like my husband would say, I would say, well, you know, he did give me flowers, but I remember once he said, you know, I show my love for you by making sure all the bills in his house is paid. And I'm like, oh, okay, right. Kind of not romantic, but I guess it's all right.
I take it.
You know, so Dr. Ann Modi Lewis, tell our listeners a little bit about yourself. Just bring Ellen and I up to speed about what has been happening in your life the last few years. You have been a constant on our show. We appreciate your support. And we appreciate everything you've done to keep Viewpoint with Sita and Friends on air.
Thank you. I think the most important thing that has happened to me is I published another book called Playbook for Life, which is quotes on, I think, 30 different topics. Love is one of them. Spirituality, children, marriage, relationships, anger, etc. And they're just short little reads that you can just pick up. Open it up, read it in the morning, and then think about it during the day. And then that is connected with the birthing of a new spiritual community that we will be launching shortly. It's called Caring People, a spiritual community for everyone. It is completely lay-run, and we now have a website, Caring People Florida, FL, and I will be doing many lectures on many, meaning for about 4 to 5 minutes, lectures on a different topic every month. You can go in and watch the lecture and read my daily writing. So that's called Psycho-Spiritual, in which I'm putting together psychology, healing psychology, with spirituality, because we are confused about spirituality. We confuse it with religion, and that's very unfortunate.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think as we get older, we all become more spiritual. Because I think it's because we know that, you know, two things are truth in life, right? We're going to be born and we're going to die at some point. And we want to leave a footprint behind for the next generation. And that means that whatever our life experience and the challenges we face in our life, we're trying to give it back to the next generation. And I see that a lot on your Facebook. You talk a lot about no one can take charge of our health, and no one could understand our comfort level, and no one could actually understand our journey as well, just us.
I want to, that's a very good thought, Sita. I want to just make one alteration. You said as we become older, we become spiritual. And my position is, my main point is that we are always spiritual. We are spiritual the day we are born. And it is the greatest challenge of our life to recognize spirituality in our lives. That is the invisible reality that we have become unconscious to. You were saying earlier that your husband said, you know, he pays all the bills and that's his love for you. That's very secular. But spiritual is listening to the music and eating food with our family and talking about our conflicts and recognizing God's footprints in our lives as we remember our life stories.
Right, and I think you're right, because people do confuse religion with spirituality. Now, being Hindu, you're right, we were spiritual from the day we were born, and we were taught that in our temples and our homes. But I find a lot of my friends do still have difficulties, and they'll say, well, I am getting spiritual as I get older. And so that's why I said that. But more important, a lot of the things you talk about on your Facebook, and you and I have spoken about together, is how do we get more families to sit down at their kitchen table and talk about the importance of spirituality as well as other things? What has happened to the American family that people just don't, even if they have the time, a lot of them don't sit down and talk about it?
Right. Well, let me say that people are communicating a lot today, probably more than ever before. However, we're doing it electronically. So we are not in each other's presence. We are not face to face, eye to eye, body to body. And that lack of connectivity leaves us wanting. So we are looking at our phones, we are reading a message from a loved one who may be on another continent or across the ocean or wherever they are. So we're talking a lot, but we're not personal. We're not intimate. So it is the intimacy that's lacking. And now sitting around the table, which is the conversation that we're having today, is the most intimate experience. Let's just look at that for a second. Because to sit around the table, someone had to go out and buy the food that was grown by somebody. And they had to put that food together. They had to prepare it lovingly or whatever, in whatever way, to bring that food to the table. We come and we sit down at the table, hopefully without our phones. Never, ever should people eat with their telephones beside them, on them. They should put their phones off and take that time aside so that we have the time to talk. So the table is a gathering place.
Yes, I totally agree. And you know, sometimes you go to restaurants and everybody sitting at the table is on their phone. And I'm guilty of that as well. And my children started this new thing where they'll say, Mom, if I'm taking you out for lunch, you have to put your phone down. And it's kind of sad that they have to say that. But you know what? It is a reminder that I'm guilty of it as well.
Well, and they even have it in the kid loop, right? When you go pick up your child in elementary school.
So we are becoming a more remote culture. We are becoming more remote. That means that even in each other's presence, we're not present.
Absolutely.
Presence means that I am with you mindfully. I am with you mindfully. I see your the way you eat, what you like to eat. I see the conversation. During what is it that you talk about? What's on your mind? So the gathering at the table, you know, Christ gathered his apostles around the table for the breaking of the bread. And he did that very mindfully because, of course, he was Middle Eastern and food is very much a part of that culture. And he picked up bread that may have been laying around the table. And he broke that bread and he said, this is me. This is who I am. And he took the cup that we have wine and we have waters at our table. And he said, and this is my blood. So what he's saying is what we are sharing here is who I am. And what we share around the table is who we are.
Well, you know, we sit here every Monday and we talk about things that are going on around the world, here in Brevard County, in our state, and we talk about kitchen table topics, and we talk about things like affordable housing. We talk about the homeless population in the United States. We speak about health insurance. We talk about an affordable wage. We talk about how to get people a job and skills when they lose a job. We talk about these things. And I think in the old days, that's what families did. They sat around a table. And if someone says they want to marry a girl or they want to marry a boy or they want to marry whoever they love, whatever it was, families would jump in and say, well, where are you going to live? Are you planning to have children? Do you have a job? How are you planning to take care of your health? I mean, and the conversation started with, well, that goes into everything that affects human beings. You know, a well-rounded person, if you have a child, are you able to take care of it? But nowadays, it's like nobody wants to take that time to ask challenging questions around their kitchen table anymore. For example,
I think that It's not that people don't want to do it. It's that people don't understand the importance of it.
That's right.
If they understood the importance of it. See, I have a problem really with defining our culture in negative ways, because I don't think that contributes to anything. People are just not aware. That is what we're talking about now, is a spiritual experience. So that when we gather, whenever we gather around, usually we have food on some form or fashion. And food brings people together in a multiplicity of ways. And
they're all smiling in the studio, because that's how we get all, it's food. We do.
Right. All right. So it's not that people don't want to do it. You see, when we started this conversation with people, we are not aware of our spiritual existence. And that spiritual existence becomes known to us when we sit around the table in very mundane ways. You know, I have a lecture now that's on, it's a 30-minute lecture, and it's on Facebook for anyone who would like to read watch it. And I recorded it for a spiritual congregation in Central Florida. And I talk about the mundane ways that we experience spirituality. Like when I was a kid, in the street, going down into the cellar where my grandmother was making pita bread and taking a big swab of butter from the tub of butter and smearing it on our bread and not worrying about cholesterol or anything and running out, and my grandmother, you know, and picking grapes in my grandfather's vineyard. These are spiritual experiences.
So the kitchen table is symbolic. It is symbolic of family unity, is what you're saying.
And spirituality.
It is ritual. It is the rituals that we create in the family that makes the family understand what life is about. So they feel the connectedness, even if they disagree. Okay? They have someone to disagree with in person, face to face. That is intimacy. I think what we're talking about here is not so much the lack of communication as the lack of intimacy.
Gotcha.
Intimacy. Intimacy is when I look at you. I'm talking to you right now.
Eye contact. Yeah, so you make eye contact.
You make eye contact. You make body contact. You can disagree. You can, you know, you can do whatever you need to do. You can have a conversation.
Hi, Dr. Lewis. This is Samantha. I'm the newest addition here to Zeta and Friends. I get to sit with these amazing ladies every Monday. Welcome. It's my first show with you, and I do have a question for you. What happens if we don't gather?
If we don't gather, we don't stay connected. We become more isolated, and we are becoming a more isolated, remote society. If we don't gather, we become more isolated, less known to each other.
So, you know,
we become, and in our isolation, wait just one moment. In our isolation, there is a loneliness that precipitates anxiety and depression, the two most important emotional illnesses in our culture, anxiety and depression.
Wow. So, Ellen, we all watched, you know, even though we have the COVID-19 restrictions and they were telling everybody to wear masks, don't get on the aircrafts, we saw so many people still getting together for Christmas and Thanksgiving because they wanted that connection with their family, correct?
Yes.
So, and people wanted to carry on those traditions. Even people risk everything to even peep outside the window to see grandma and grandpa because traditions are so important. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And
they are very prevalent.
Right. Yes. And so you're
calling them traditions, Sita. You're calling them traditions. I'm calling them rituals. But they're the same thing. Rituals and traditions are the same thing.
Right. Ellen, let's ask around here. So what? Tell me one of the traditions that your family had with you all around Christmas.
Well,
or Thanksgiving.
Thanksgiving was probably more of a popular holiday with my family, but we went to the Macy's Day Parade every year, and then the years that we didn't go to the Macy's Day Parade when we lived in Florida, we would all watch it. So it was like a big deal. We would start the turkey at 5 o'clock in the morning, and by 6:30, everybody was starting to drink and watch the parade.
And what a beautiful thing, right? And Sam, I'm pretty sure you had something too.
Yeah, ours, Thanksgiving is pretty big, but our thing is Christmas. My grandmother used to buy a birthday cake, and there was a happy birthday baby Jesus, because she wanted us to know it wasn't about the gifts, it was about the birth of our Savior.
Right, and that's beautiful, because you could carry that, like Dr. Lewis said, the ritual on. Now, in our family, we weren't very wealthy, but my father would spend and buy 2 apples and a pound of grapes. And he would slice that apple up in 18 pieces, and he would share that, give every child a piece of apple and a couple of grapes. And we knew on Christmas morning, no matter how poor we were, and that signified for us, it came from America, and it also meant to us that it's Christmas morning, that we would have a slice of apple and 2 or 3 grapes in the palm of our hand. And I have tried to carry on that ritual or tradition too. But Dr. Lewis is absolutely correct, because those are the small things that all 18 of us carry with us for Christmas. And although I'm not Christian, Christmas was a huge holiday in Trinidad and Tobago. So Dr. Lewis, talk to us a little bit about traditions and rituals, and how do we create more with our families?
Well, I think that's a beautiful story, by the way.
Thank you.
The rituals and traditions are something that children especially cling to. Like you're clinging to that because that meant something to you. It is a very human experience that teaches us the deepest meaning of life. Okay, we can't wait for holidays to have traditions. There should be weekly traditions, like Sunday, or maybe during the week, where we sit together, and parents have to really work on that. One of the things that I ask families all the time, clients, did your family eat together? See, it tells me a lot. Because if the family never ate together, then the family really wasn't together, and the children really didn't feel together. So what I want to keep reiterating, what we're talking about here now, is that rituals recreate the intimacy of life in simple ways, like apple and grapes, like a turkey that you put in the oven and you eat at 6 o'clock at night. They ritualize the humanness of life in a very intimate way. Intimacy is so important. That's what's missing from our culture. Not so much communication as intimacy.
So the takeaway from today's show is for all of us to recognize the importance of putting the phones down, sitting down around the kitchen table, and talking to our families, not just because we want to communicate, but we want to be intimate and find out exactly what is going on in someone's life and what we can do to leave an impression that the next generation, if they're sitting there, can create their own memory with their family and continue forward. Now, I started on Fridays, I'm off, so I started going to the gym, getting dressed, cooking, and taking food to Orlando to visit with my newborn grandson, James, and my daughter. And I want to continue that tradition on Fridays because I'm off. But so what you're saying is it's okay if it's a weekly tradition. Just follow it. It doesn't have to be a huge holiday like Christmas or Thanksgiving or birthday.
No, it can't be. It can't be, because that's not enough.
Right.
You see, that's just not enough. We, at least a weekly basis, we should be gathering around the table. And God bless the families that gather around the table every night. Now, sometimes in the busyness of life, we really can't do that. But, you know, it's very important that even when mothers cook for their children, that they eat with their children. Not just cook for them, eat with them. So you can listen to what's on their mind. You can talk about what's going on in their lives and how they're feeling. That's intimacy. I think the most important thing in the show is to talk about gatherings create intimacy. But we have to be, and not let technology take the place of intimacy.
I love what you just said. So gatherings should lead to intimacy.
Right. When you're sitting in the restaurant with your children, Sita, and you're on your phone, you're there, but you're not there. So intimacy can't happen.
So we have two minutes. We're going to give you an extra minute. So tell us, what is, if someone wanted to get a hold of you and learn more of what you're doing to help us human beings on this planet, How can they get a hold of you?
They can go on Facebook or Twitter. They can go to my website, A. Lewis & Associates. They can go to Caring People Florida. You can get a hold of me in all of those places.
I
write very generously. Every day, like today, I wrote, the appreciation of your life is recognizing God's footprints in your history.
Oh, okay. Well, look at that. I had one question that came over my phone. The person wanted you to, if you can, in a minute or two. This past year, with dealing with COVID-19 and the challenges of that, we also had a lot of families who were politically pulled apart because of politics. In a minute or two, Dr. Lewis, how do we mend those broken relationships?
You know, that's a profound question. I think that we have to respect each other's opinions and not let those opinions become reasons for separation. If your opinion is different than mine, you have that right. We both have that right. But if I expect your opinion to be like my opinion in order for me to have a relationship with you, now I have set up a requirement that is impossible. So if someone is conservative in their viewpoints, then they have the right to be conservative. We can't fight about someone's right to have an opinion. We have to give them that. We have to respect them that. We have to respect that about them. That is part of love. The word love, it contains the word respicere, which means to see, to appreciate, to respect another person's right, even if you don't agree with it.
So in order to make life better for everyone else, we all need to slow down, take a deep breath, and understand that people have a right to the way they think. But what about people's actions? Because I notice, you know, sometimes you'll have neighbors not speaking to neighbors because of their actions. What do we do when someone's actions now is an impediment to being forgiven or being able to have a relationship with that person?
I'm assuming that you're talking about a hostile action. A hostile action.
Yes.
And a hostile action, they could do harm to another person because that person doesn't agree with you or think the same as you, is dangerous, and I think you should separate yourself from them and hope that they can overcome their hostility.
Yeah, because we saw a lot of that this past election season, yes. And people, and it was kind of sad because, you know, people were like, well, I used to always talk to this gentleman or this lady, and a lot of my friends were reporting that some of their neighbors were not very neighborly with their flags and, you know, their signs. And I said, well, at some point, we're all going to have to move on and forgive and just try to make things work out, because you have to live in that community. And some people just hold that grudge and they just don't know how to let go.
Well, those people who don't know how to let go and cannot modulate their anger or hostility are people who have pre-existing hostility within them, and they don't know how to manage it or self-correct. So, and there's really not a lot that you can do about that except pray for them and keep yourself away from them and be kind to them. Because those are the people who need kindness most.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for calling in. Dr. Ann Modi Lewis from Fort Lauderdale. And if you've heard our show, the first segment, we've had a fantastic conversation about just family and about connecting with people and staying connected. So hopefully you tuned in. And if not, we'll have the show on archive, and it'll be on our show shortly, on our Facebook page shortly.
We'll be right back after these short these messages.
Portions of Viewpoint with Sita and Friends is sponsored by the friends and family of Sita Begee, author of 18 Brothers and Sisters, and founder of Simply Sita Skincare, and these great sponsors. When you need medical care and need it fast, MedFast Urgent Care is faster and less expensive than emergency rooms. MedFast is open 7 days a week, now with 13 locations, including one in Volusia County. With so many MedFast Urgent Care Centers, there is a MedFast near you. MedFast offers top quality care that is close by, and the number is easy to remember. That is 321-MEDFAST. You just call 321-MEDFAST. No one wants to wait in an emergency room for hours and get even sicker when you get the high bill. What you want is medical care fast. That's why you call MEDFAST, where most patients are seen and treated in less than an hour. So when you need medical care fast, call 321-MEDFAST. MEDFAST. Located in Titusville, Florida, Dixie Crossroads has been serving great-tasting seafood, char-grilled steaks, prime rib, chicken, fresh salads, and their famous corn fritters for over 31 years. The menu features the very best local shrimp and fish from Port Canaveral and ranges from low-cost sandwiches and baskets to high-end seafood combos. Visit this Florida favorite at 1475 Garden Street in Titusville. That's Dixie Crossroads, 321-268-5000. 321-268-5000, or visit them on the web at dixiecrossroads.com. Jotkoff Financial Group is a certified public accounting and a registered investment advisory firm with over 30 years of productive relationships with clients. Jotkoff Financial Group can assist you in meeting your accounting, tax, and business consulting and financial planning and insurance needs without expanding your internal workforce. With three locations here in Florida, here in Brevard County, Broward County, and Nassau County, contact Jotkoff Financial Group here in Brevard at 321-984-7345, located at 1122 South Wickham Road in Melbourne. That's Jotkoff Financial Group. On the web, you'll find them at www.jotkoff, that's JOTKOFF.com. Call the professionals at Jotkoff Financial Group today.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Sita Begee on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. We had such a wonderful segment with our good friend, Dr. Anne Modi-Lewis, who took the time from her busy practice to call in from Fort Lauderdale. Ellen, myself, and Samantha are here every Monday talking to our friends and our guests and our sponsors and learning so much. And I really love it when a guest calls in and I learn something from them. Like, you know, I said that my husband said showing love is through paying bills, which is what my father used to do as well, Ellen.
Right. And I think, like what he had said originally, sort of traditional, right? We're just used to that role
right
in our families, that that's what it is. So my brothers were like that. My father was like that.
And Samantha, you know, said her family's like that.
Yeah, my dad's not a very mushy, huggy, I love you kind of person. Like, I think I've seen my dad cry 4 times in my lifetime. And one was at my wedding when he's like, I'm so happy I was wrong. I'm like, oh, thanks. Good to know.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're not very, culturally, they're not very huggy, I love you. I'm the total opposite with my kid. I'm all over him.
You know, when you learn about the world, its peoples and its cultures, you learn so much. Like my husband would say, I'm not going to, he did buy flowers this time, but mostly he would take me outside and show me a plant that has a flower and say, that's love. But I'd be like, no, I really want a real rose, not to see. But, you know, Dr. Lewis made such a great point about gathering at the family table creates an atmosphere for intimacy. And looking at each other, body language, eyes, and finding out what's going on in your life and your children's life and all that. So I'm going to take that home to Dr. Begee, and then he's going to say, put your phone down.
Right. He's going to come to you with a cell phone bowl and be like, stick it in here.
But she was awesome. I like what she had to say. Yeah. And, you know, it's just like, you know, we're living in an age when social media has so much conspiracy theories, and people are just reading, and sometimes they're not reading the correct things, right?
Well, and it's left to interpretation.
And it's good to have live guests call in and say to us, put that phone down and talk. Because that's what we talk. We talk here on Mondays.
Even look what social media has done to families. You used to send your family a picture of your children from school. Nobody does that anymore. Just look at the picture. I put it on Facebook. You can look at it. I don't got to put a stamp on it. But those letters, those pictures, that intimacy is gone with so much social media. So I really learned a lot today with Dr. Lewis. That was, whoa.
Well, you know, well, while we're waiting on our other guest to call in from California, I hope she remembered, we can keep talking, Ellen. So we were going
to
talk.
Oh, just to remember, it's Eastern Standard Time, so she might be
a little
off. I hope
you made sure to make that clear.
I know Ellen did. Yes, Ellen did. So if you want to go back to that post and remind her, Elle, that would be great. But here's the thing, you know, when we talk about kitchen table topics and what's going on around with our family and friends, it's amazing that some family members do have a form of anxiety, and they're afraid to talk to other family members about what's going on in their life, right? So what do you do when you have a relative or a friend that wouldn't come forward because they don't trust you? And I think trust is important. Respect is important. How do you bring that person out of their shell, Samantha?
I think you'd have to start from a place of earning that trust.
Yes.
Earning that trust, and that person's not going to judge you. Because a lot of times in a family, when someone doesn't want to discuss an issue, it's they're afraid of the judgment.
It's like mental health. If you want to discuss mental health or anxiety, in my culture, I know I'm Indian. You know, my family from India. I was born in the Caribbean. And a lot of times, certain issues like domestic violence, mental health in our families was swept under the rug.
Right.
You know, I remember people would get beat up the night before, and the next morning they have to wake up with a big bruise, black eye, cooked lunch for their husband, washed clothes, the entire village walking by, knowing that that woman got beaten up. That woman happened to be my mother sometimes. Mm-hmm. And it was sad, you know. So I do think, you know, in some ways, talking about issues around the table and being intimate does help.
And the perception, too. We have to go in curiosity, not in judgment, right? So if there's a lot of people that are quiet, maybe wallflowers, and then somebody in a room will say, well, they're being stuck up, or they're being, you know, antisocial. Well, there might be a reason why. So why don't you go in curiosity? Go ask
the question. Put the phone down and question.
Put the phone down.
So exactly, on our second segment, Elle, is Dr. Alka Kanaya, and she's I hope I'm saying it correctly. She's a professor of medicine. She's calling in from San Francisco, and I'm so delighted to have her on. So I'm going to stop talking and have her say hello to our friends on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends here in sunny Cocoa, Florida. And tell us a little bit about yourself, Doctor.
Hi, thank you for having me, Sita. So I have been working as an internal medicine doctor at UCSF since 2000, and I am doing research on why South Asians have so much heart disease. And this is a long-term study we've had for at least the last 10 years now.
Yes. So what made you interested in studying the health of South Asia? And I'm imagining that this would be also applicable to other races as well, correct?
Well, actually, what we've done is create a longitudinal cohort. Like there are several other cohorts for white Americans, like the Framingham study. There's cohorts that include African Americans and blacks, like the REGARD study and other long-term studies. There are no long-term studies in South Asians. These are people who come from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka. And what we know about these, you know, populations of people who live in the United States is actually very little. And we know that in other countries, there seems to be a higher risk of heart attacks in people of South Asian descent, and no one understands why. And so without actually having data among South Asians, it's really hard to understand or answer these questions.
I'm surprised that there wasn't a study done the way you did it, knowing that, my goodness, so many Indians are doctors, right? But like you said, there was a study for every other race but us. So thank you for doing that, because, you know, we always think of ourselves like in a separate group, but yet still nobody takes that action to actually look after us.
Exactly. So, yes, there are several physicians and other healthcare providers of Indian and South Asian background, but there are no long-term data among these populations. There's some now that's being developed in the UK and some that's being developed in India as well, but, you know, until 2010, there were really no such long-term data. So that's when we started this study, and we're lucky to have funding from the NIH to do this. And one of the biggest reasons that I think we did get funding is that we're comparing the South Asian cohort called MASALA to another U.S. cohort that includes whites, African Americans, Latinos, and Chinese. So they have four race ethnic groups in the U.S. in the MESA study, multi-ethnic study of atherosclerosis, And our Masala study compares the South Asians directly to the four other groups. So it's kind of leveraging, you know, all this great data we have in four other U.S. groups with now combining together with the South Asian group to look at, are there similarities and are there differences and why? That's the reason.
Wow.
Doctor, we have a question for you here. What are some of the main lessons you have learned about South Asian health?
Yeah. So what we've learned is South Asians have many more risk factors for heart disease than other groups. They have higher rates of diabetes, higher rates of high blood pressure. And some of the important reasons why is that when you look at where their body fat is put in the body, when you use CT scans and other ways of measuring body fat, that the body fat is stored in all the wrong places. It's stored inside the liver, inside muscle tissue, around the heart, and around the intestines of the abdomen, rather than under the skin where other people tend to store body fat. It goes in the wrong places in South Asians. And why may that be? That could be several reasons related to some having to do with the genetics of where, you know, people store body fat. But we also know that having excess body fat given by some of the dietary traditions that people follow.
So there goes my roti. There goes my roti. Yeah. There goes my fried plantains. There goes my fried. Yeah, I think you're right. So, you know, of course, I think diet has a lot to do with it. But what is it, I mean, about us? My comfort food is curry. And it could be curry, anything. But I when I eat it, I would never get depressed. I'm happy. I remember my childhood. I remember my mother making food. And so a lot of my Indian friends are saying, you know what, it's our diet. So what do we do when we have a craving and we don't want to give up what we grew up on?
Yeah, no, it's not about giving up. It's about modifying, and it's about moderation. And I think that's the key is there are healthier ways to cook some foods that get rid of trans fats and heavy, you know, saturated fats, as well as carbohydrates, and you know, smaller portions, and maybe not every day is another way of thinking about moderation in some of the things that are, you know, traditional and that, you know, are palatable and you enjoy and remind you of home. So it's not about giving up. It's about, you know, tailoring.
Everything in moderation. So, you know, while preparing for our show today, I was, of course, being a nurse, I never really read up a lot about diabetes because we just go in. If a patient's blood sugar is high, we give a shot. And if it's low, we give them some glucose. But as I was preparing for the show, I was reading about the medical term diabetes and where it came from. An ancient Greek word means to pass through. And because people with diabetes have to pass urine frequently. And I was like, wow. So then I said, I wonder what got Dr. Kanaya interested in doing the study on diabetes. So how did you end up?
It in my family. You know, I'm Indian in background. I was born in India, moved to the U.S. when I was 6 years old. But, you know, many of my grandparents, my aunts, uncles, relatives have had long-term diabetes and have had a lot of consequences of their diabetes. So it was, you know, very prevalent in my own family, and I saw it in my patients as I was practicing here, and it really made me curious about why, first of all, because people are not generally considered obese when they're Indian, and they still have diabetes and all of the consequences, and worse sometimes consequences.
Yeah, because in lay terms, people would say, well, he's so skinny and he has diabetes. You're right.
That's right.
And it has nothing to do with the body fat. So in preparing for the show, where I was learning about the five types of diabetes. And then I said, I wonder why you concentrated only on the type 2 for the study?
Yeah, type 2 reflects about 95% of all diabetes in South Asians. So there's very little type 1, and the other types 3, 4, 5 are not common at all. And so type 2 is the epidemic. That's what's growing in numbers all around the world, and that has a lot to do with globalization, with our diet, with, you know, not enough exercise, with easy access to calories that are not necessarily healthy calories that don't provide nutrition but just provide a lot of excess calories. So there's many, many reasons that, you know, the entire world is experiencing higher rates of diabetes, and it really is – the epicenter of the epidemic is in India and in China now, and in terms of the numbers of people who have type 2 diabetes. And so this is a real problem, and it's one of the biggest risk factors for heart disease. So if we want to get to the bottom of why so many, you know, South Asians experience heart attacks 10 years earlier than most other people, we have to understand, well, is diabetes a big driver of that? And how do we prevent it? Is by preventing diabetes and preventing other behaviors that may be leading to this problem. So it's not only about diet. We also found that, you know, South Asians don't exercise compared to other groups in that comparison study I told you about, MESA. The South Asians in our study were the least likely to be, you know, exercising on a regular basis. So this is a modifiable thing.
Yeah, because we like to eat too much. That's a problem. You go to the Hindu temple and everybody there is eating and eating. And look, let's go for a walk afterwards. No, I got to go home and go to work, you know. But exactly. So with type 2 diabetes, the body loses its ability to use insulin effectively, right? So how do we get more people to understand that? Because apparently somewhere along the line with our own people, we lost that with the South Asians. I mean, when do we start teaching people about hypoglycemia, hyperglycemia, moderation, exercise, insulin? I've been exercising every day. I walk 2 miles. Maybe that's why, even though I'm a little bit obese, I'm all right. But how do we get that across to our fellow human beings?
Yeah, no, it starts early in life, earlier the better, and making exercise a part of, you know, your child or your grandchild's every day, and making it a routine that the whole family takes part in. And walking is the best exercise. You know, you can go to the gym and work out, you know, when gyms are open. You know, just walking 30 minutes a day and, you know, watching or eating a moderation type of diet can be the best solution to prevent diabetes. This has been shown in studies and in India as well as in the United States. 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week of walking can help prevent diabetes. So getting these, you know, messages that start in early, you know, youth, and you stay active, and there's nothing better for a child to see and use exercise in their whole life. If they start seeing their mother and their father, especially their mother, exercising, that makes a real big impact in the child's life, and they keep doing it, and then they pass on these good behaviors to their children and so on.
Dr. Kanaya, how can our listeners learn more about what you're doing?
Yeah, you're welcome to go to our study website, Masala Study, MASALA study.org, and we have, you know, every paper we've published, and we make it real easy to understand. We have blogs in lay terms about what we've found. We have health resources and health tips. We have videos, and we have lots of information about healthy nutrition. If you're eating a South Asian diet, some of these modifications you can make to have, you know, more plant-based foods, and how to cook in a healthier way, the curries that you enjoy, how many carbs are there if you're diabetic, you know, in those lentils that you eat. There are actually maybe some that are filled with carbs and some that are healthier. So all that information is on our website, so please check out masalastudy.org. And, you know, get involved. We're hosting a lot of community forums all over the U.S. I'm happy to come and speak to any, you know, community group that is organizing in your area and wants more information about, you know, strategies to prevent heart attacks and prevent diabetes in the community.
That's really great information. So how can our listeners get more involved in research studies? Because as we all know, I mean, we're watching CNN and MSNBC and Fox, whatever people watch the news, and we're seeing how many people of color did not get involved in the COVID-19 research studies.
Yeah,
and now a lot of them don't want to take the vaccine because they didn't get involved. How do we get more people involved in your research, what you're doing?
Yeah, so, you know, the Masala study is ongoing. We are doing our third exam where we bring back, you know, 1,000 of our participants to do more research. We're not including new people right now in the study, but there is another way that Asians of all types, Asian Americans, can get involved in research, and that is a big registry that we're putting together of people who want to be contacted when there's new research studies and want to get involved, so that they have their name in a registry so it's easy for them to hear about research studies, and they can choose whether they want to participate or not. But please join this. It's called CARE Registry. And if you Google, you know, CARE, C-A-R-E, Registry at UCSF, it's the first thing that comes up. And it just takes 10 minutes to sign up if you're an Asian American, Native Hawaiian, or Pacific Islander. These are majorly underrepresented groups in any type of research studies done in the United States. You can sign up to be in this registry so that when there are future studies, that the investigators will know to contact you by email or phone or whatever you choose, and you can choose to join their study or not. Part of the problem is people are not hearing about these studies because, scientists aren't reaching out to those communities to get them involved, but we want to make this easier for people to hear about studies. So please join the CARE Registry as a way of signaling that you are interested and you want to volunteer and, you know, you want to have representation.
And be part of the solution. So we all hear about the A1C and, you know, the diabetic number that we all want to have. And for decades, doctors talk about labs. They talk about blood pressure, cholesterol. You should know your A1C. For our listeners who are tuned in to Viewpoint with Sita and Friends today on all our FM stations and AM and online, what are the most common signs and symptoms of diabetes type 1 and type 2? If you could just go through some of the ones that are most common, that would really help. Because we do have a lot of people that eat too much and don't exercise, not just in the Indian culture, but a lot of cultures.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, so the most common signs of, you know, developing diabetes, someone who's having diabetes, is fatigue and too much urination, feeling like you have to go to the bathroom constantly. And that's because the glucose that you're eating, so every food you eat gets broken down into glucose in your body, but your body is unable to use that glucose. And so the glucose is passing through, as you said, the definition of diabetes, and you're peeing it out. And so a lot of people with new diabetes start to notice that they're peeing a lot more frequently, and they're really tired, really exhausted, dehydrated. And that's generally the first signs of, problems with probably too high a sugar in your bloodstream that isn't going to, you know, feed your cells like it needs to. And some other people start to notice that they get tingling and numbness in their feet and sometimes in their hands, and that's a very early symptom of diabetes as well.
So we just want to tell our listeners, we're so delighted. It's just such an honor to have Dr. Alka Kanaya, who is a professor of medicine and epidemiology and biostatics from the University of California, San Francisco, USF. What an honor for you to call in on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. We just have about 3 minutes left, and we have a couple more questions.
Hi, doctor. Is diabetes something that is inevitable for most South Asians?
No, that's a really good question. No, it's not, and that's the hopeful message. That's the, you know, glass half full message. Is there's many things you can do, even if you're, you know, family members have type 2 diabetes. You can prevent this by exercising every day. Like I said, a walk 30 minutes a day really is the best medicine, as well as, you know, watching your diet, avoiding carbohydrates that is like, you know, white rice, white bread, pasta, potatoes. These things are, not healthy carbohydrates. You want to move to healthier plant-based foods. And we've shown in our study that people who eat more of the healthy plant-based foods, like fresh leafy dark green vegetables, other fresh vegetables, and nuts and legumes and whole grains, that people who are eating like that tend to have lower rates of developing diabetes. So it really is in your control. It's not inevitable. It starts with having to make the right, you know, behavioral lifestyle choices.
So you're saying white is not right?
not
in a skin color way, but in food, like pasta, white flour, bread. You know, it's
everything,
almost,
like,
everything we like.
Yeah.
So, and
probably
then
brown is better.
Brown is the crown. So being overweight is the number one risk factor for developing type 2 diabetes.
For South Asians, it's actually being overweight is not the best risk factor, because a lot of South Asians will develop diabetes even with a normal BMI. So, you know, the BMI is the calculation of your weight and your height together. And for Asians, a BMI even around 23, which is normal, can have a lot of diabetes. Like I said, there's a lot of fat hidden in the wrong places. So you may not overtly look like you're overweight or obese, but the fat is in the wrong places that's leading to some of these abnormalities in how your body can process glucose. So I wouldn't rely on your weight as being the risk factor for diabetes. I would get tested no matter what. And that's a simple, you know, blood test to look at your glucose levels, your hemoglobin A1C levels. After the age of 40, people should be getting these blood tests done every year routinely to monitor and to make sure that they're not developing diabetes.
Right. And, you know, what you have laid out for us is so simple if people would just listen, right? So we give out the valuable information. It's up to people to act on it. And so, doctor, next time you call in, I mean, I'd love to have you call back in because, you know, in the news lately, there's been so much talk about the cost of insulin. If people could just weigh the cost of insulin and just eating right and moderation and exercising, it would really be a healthier, happier world, wouldn't it?
Yeah, no, definitely. And, you know, most people with diabetes can control it so that they don't end up having to need insulin, too. So that's the good news is, you know, there are many, many ways to prevent ever getting, you know, getting type 2 diabetes so badly out of control that you end up having to need insulin. That's a very end stage problem of type 2 diabetes. And hopefully if people are doing these lifestyle changes, really getting to the bottom of the problem, you know, not putting Band-Aids on the solution, but really trying to, you know, make diabetes preventable or managed as well as possible, there doesn't need to be a reason to have any of these complications or need insulin.
What an educational show today.
I love it. I could have her on for 2 hours. Oh my God.
And the fact that it is preventable gives people, it should give people hope.
Hey, you watch that pasta today, Miss Ellen.
Exactly.
Amen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. And all that potatoes and roti and all that.
Amen, sister.
Doctor, you're so awesome. Thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you so much, Sita,
okay.
For another
Thank you. Have a great day.
You
Thank
too.
Thank you.
Wow.
Another fantastic show. And Samantha and Sita, you did a great job getting these two great guests.
You did a great job too, my girlfriend.
It's all good. So we are going to be back here at 1 o'clock next Monday on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends with two more great guests, right?
Yes.
Some great, more great conversation. Hopefully everybody have their pens and paper ready for take down any information that they need. And we'll see you next week here on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends.
The preceding program may not necessarily reflect the views of the staff or management of WWBC. You're listening to WWBC, COCO, Melbourne, Titusville, 1510 AM, as well as W234BI, COCO, Rockledge, and W264AS, Rockledge, Melbourne, and Palm Bay, 100.7 FM.